Mouth opens wider still, its head tilting sideways. It falls forward onto the carriage, which rolls and pitches it off onto the road's gravelled surface. On all sides, hungries stir to life, swivelling their heads like rangefinders. "Move," Parks growls. "On me!" Then he bellows. "Run!" Chapter 33. They almost die in the first few seconds, because in spite of Parks's yell, the others freeze. It just seems like there's nowhere to run to. Hungries are swarming in them from every direction, the gaps between them closing as they converge. But there's only one direction that matters, and Parks sets to work to open it up again. Three shots drop three of the sprinting dead in their tracks. Two shots miss. Parks gives Justinu a violent shove, gets her running. Gallagher does the same for Dr. Caldwell, and the little hungry kid, Melanie, is already going flat out. They jump over the fallen hungries, which are scrabbling like cockroaches trying to right themselves. If Parks had the time, if the seconds that are ticking by weren't shaping up to be the last seconds of their lives, he'd have tried for headshots. As it is, he goes for central body mass, and the best odds for sending them down. Works fine, up until Justinu goes sprawling. One of the hold hungries has grabbed her leg and is swarming up it, hand over hand. Parks stops long enough to unload a second bullet into the hollow under the ear of the ex-human predator. It lets go. Justinu is up again in an instant, not looking back. Good. Lot's wife should have had that kind of focus. He's shooting to left and right, only taking out the closest, the ones that are about to jump or grab. Gallagher is doing the same thing and, though his hit rate is shit, at least he's not slowing to shoot. That's better than having him aim like Deadeye Dick and stand still long enough to get tackled. They're at the gates now, and there's no lock on them that Parks can see, but they don't open. Used to be electric, obviously. But bygones are bygones, and in the brave new post-mortem world, that just means they don't bloody work. "Over!" he yells. "Up and over!" Which is easily said. A head-high rampart of ornamental ironwork with functional spear points on top says different. They try, all the same. Parks leaves them to it, turns his back to them and goes on firing. The upside is that now he can be indiscriminate. Set to full auto and aim low. Cut the hungry's legs out from under them, turning the front runners into trip hazards to slow the ones behind. The downside is that more and more of them keep coming. The noise is like a dinner bell. Hungries are crowding into the green space from the streets on every side at what you'd have to call a dead run. There's no limit to their numbers. And there is a limit to his ammo. Which he hits, suddenly. The gun stops vibrating in his hands, and the noise of his shots dies away through layers of echoes. He ejects the empty magazine, gropes for another in his pocket. He's done this so often he could go through the moves in his sleep. Slap the new mag in and give it a quick, sharp tug, pivoting it on the forward lip so it locks into place, pull the bolt all the way back. The bolt sticks halfway. The weapon's just dead weight until he can clear whatever's jamming it. The first round, most likely, elbowed in the chamber. And two hungries are on top of him now, triangulating from left and right. One of them used to be a man, the other a woman. They're about a second away from the world's nastiest three-way. It's just instinct. Faulty learning. He takes a step back, groping for his sidearm instead of swinging the rifle like a club. Wastes a second that he doesn't have, and it's all over. Except that it isn't. In combat, Parks narrows down. It's not even a conscious thing so much, or a trick he's learned. It just happens. He does the job that's in front of him, and pretty much shunts everything else into a holding pattern. So he's forgotten about the hungry kid, until she's suddenly there, right in front of him. She's inserted herself into the narrowing space between him and his attackers. She's flailing at them with her skinny arms, an atom of defiance with a shrill, shrieking war cry. And the Hungries stop. Breakneck sudden. Their eyes defocus. Their heads start to turn to left and right in short arcs like they're sad or disapproving. They're not looking at Parks anymore. They're looking for him. Parks knows the Hungries don't hunt or eat each other. Apart from the kids in the classroom, he's never seen a Hungry behave like it knows any other Hungries are even there. They're alone in a crowd, each one of them answering its own need. They're not pack animals. They're solitaries that cluster accidentally because they're responding to the same triggers. So he's always assumed that they can't smell each other at all. The smell of a normal man or woman drives them crazy, but other Hungries don't register. They're just not on the radar. He realizes in that numbed second that he was wrong. For each other, the Hungries must have a nothing to see here, move along kind of smell. The very opposite of how live people smell. It turns them off, where the live smell turns them on. The kid masked him. Her chemicals blocked his, just for a second or two, so the Hungries lost the pheromone trail that ended with their teeth in his throat. Plenty of others running in, though, that aren't slowing at all, and the two that the kid just wind-jammed are getting the signal again, eyes locking on target. But Gallagher's hand clamps on Parks's arm and drags him backwards through the gates, which they've managed to push half open. They're running again, the house looming ahead of them. Justino is hauling on the door, throwing it wide. They're through, the Hungry kid snaking between his legs to get in ahead of him. Gallagher slams the door shut again, which is just so much wasted time because of the two floor-to-ceiling window panels to either side of it. Stairs! Parks yells, pointing. Get up the stairs! They do, to the sound of crazed church bells as the windows shatter. Parks is bringing up the rear, throwing grenades over his back like a string of beads at a fucking Mardi Gras parade. And the grenades are going off behind them one after another, barking concussions overlapping in hideous counterpoint. Shrapnel smacks Parks's flak jacket and his unprotected legs. The last half dozen treads on the stairs sag and yaw under him, like he's stepping onto a rocking boat, but he gets to the top somehow. And falls, first to his knees, then full length, sobbing for breath. They all do. Except for the kid, who's staring back down into the gulf of air, as still and quiet as if she's just gone for an afternoon stroll. The stairs are gone, all blown to hell, and they're safe. No, they're really not. No time for sitting around and swapping stories about the one you got away from. He's got to get them on their feet again at once. Sure. They found the main gates of this place closed and the doors not broken in, but there could easily be a back door off its hinges, a window smashed in, a stretch of fence that went down last week or last year, a nest of Hungries sitting in one of the rooms up here, perking up at the sound of their approaching footsteps. So they've got to make themselves a safe base of operations. And then they've got to search, make sure there are no hostiles inside their perimeter. The place looks completely undisturbed, Parks has to admit. But just counting the doors that he can see, he knows there must be a shitload of rooms. He's not prepared to let his guard down until he's made sure that each and every one of them is secure. They advance up the corridor, trying each door in turn. Most don't open, which is fine with Parks. Whatever's on the other side of a locked door can stay there. The few that do open lead to tiny bedrooms. The beds are hospital beds with adjustable steel frames and emergency cords at the head end. Tray tables with melamine tops. Tubular steel chairs with faded burgundy seats. Ensuite bathrooms so small that the shower cubicle is bigger than the floor space outside it. Wainwright House was some kind of private hospital, not a place where people actually lived. These one-berth wards are way too claustrophobic even for two of them to share, and Parks doesn't think it's a great idea to split up, so they keep looking. And he's wondering, all this while, did the kid know what she was doing? Was she aware that she could deflect the Hungries just by stepping into their path? It's a troubling thought, because he's not sure what the significance of either a yes or a no would be. He was screwed, and the kid unscrewed him. He turns that around in his mind, but it doesn't look any better no matter which angle he comes at it from. Thinking about it just makes him angry. They hang a right off the main corridor, then a left, and eventually they find a day room that's big enough for their needs. Straight-backed chairs line the walls, which are decorated with cheap-framed prints of anonymous English pastoral scenes. Hay wains predominate. Parks is indifferent to the hay wains, and the room's got a few too many doors for his liking, but he's pretty sure by this time that it's the best they're going to find. "We'll sleep here," he tells the civilians. "But first we've got to check the rest of this floor. Make sure there are no surprises." The last "we" means himself and Gallagher, mostly, but the quicker the better for this, so he decides to rope Justinu in too. "You said you wanted to help," he reminds her. "Help with this." Justinu hesitates, looking straight at Dr. Caldwell, so it isn't hard to see what's going through her mind. She's worried about leaving Caldwell alone with the kid. But Caldwell was hit worse than anyone by the fight and flight. She's pale and sweating, breath still coming in quick pants long after the rest of them have got their second wind. "We'll be 5 minutes," Park says. "What do you think is going to happen to her in 5 minutes? His own voice surprises him, the anger and the tension in it. Justinu stares at him. Maybe Gallagher flashes him a quick look too. So he explains himself. "Easier to stay in line of sight if there are 3 of us. Kid's no use because she won't know what to look for. We go out, we come back, and they stay here so we know where to find them. Okay?" "Okay," Justinu says, but she's still looking at him hard. Like, where's that other shoe? And who's it likely to hit when it drops? She kneels and puts a hand on Melanie's shoulder. "We're going to take a quick look around," she says. "We'll be right back." "Be careful," Melanie says. Justinu nods. "Yeah." Chapter 34. Alone with Dr. Caldwell, the first thing Melanie does is to walk away to the further end of the room and put her back to the wall. She watches every move that Dr. Caldwell makes, scared and wary, ready to bolt through the open door after Miss Justinu. But Dr. Caldwell sinks into one of the chairs, either too exhausted or too lost in her own thoughts to pay any attention to Melanie. She doesn't even look at her. Any other time, Melanie would explore. All day she's been seeing new and amazing things, but Sergeant has set a brisk, steady pace, and she's never had time to stop and investigate any of the wonders that went by on both sides of the road. Trees and lakes, latticework fences, road signs pointing to places whose names she knows from her lessons, hoardings whose mostly obliterated posters have become mosaics of abstract colour. Living things, too. Birds in the air, rats and mice and hedgehogs in the weeds alongside the road. A world too big to take in all at once. Too new to have names. And now here she is, in this house that's so different from the base. There must be so many things to discover. This room alone is filled with mysteries both large and small. Why are the chairs only at the edges of the room, when the room is so enormous? Why is there a little wire cradle on the wall next to the door, with a plastic bottle in it, and a sign that says, "Cross-infection costs lives"? Why is there a faded picture on one of the tables, wild horses galloping across a field, that's been cut up into hundreds and hundreds of wiggly-shaped pieces and then stuck back together again? But right now, all Melanie wants to do is go somewhere quiet and be by herself, and she can think about the terrible thing that just happened. The terrible secret she just found out. Apart from the door that they came in by, there are 2 more doors out of the room. Melanie goes to the nearest one, keeping Dr. Caldwell, who still hasn't moved, always in the corner of her eye. She finds another room, very small and mostly white. There are white cupboards and white shelves, with black and white tiles on the walls. One of the cupboards has a window in it, and lots of dials and switches at the top. It smells of old grease. Melanie knows just about enough to guess that the cupboard with a window in it is a cooker. She's seen pictures in books. This must be a kitchen of some kind, a place where you make nice things to eat. But it's too small for her to hide in. If Dr. Caldwell came after her, she'd be trapped. She goes out again. Dr. Caldwell hasn't moved, so she walks right past her, giving her a wide berth, and goes to the other door. The next room is very different from the kitchen. Its walls are painted in bright colours and there are posters too. One shows animals of the British hedgerows, and another has words starting with each letter of the alphabet. Apple, boat, cat, digger, elephant. The pictures are cheerful and simple. The boat and the digger have smiling faces at their front ends, which Melanie is almost certain is unrealistic. There are chairs in here, too, but they're smaller, and they're all over the place in little clusters, not arranged neatly, around the edges of the room. On the floor are toys, strewn as casually as if they were put down a moment before. Girl dolls in dresses, and soldier dolls in uniform. Cars and trucks. Plastic building blocks stuck together in the shape of cars or houses or people. Animals made of plush in colours washed out almost to grey. And books. Lots of them thrown down on chairs, tables, the floor. Hundreds more on a big bookcase to one side of the door. Melanie is in no mood right then to pick them up and read them. The secret weighs heavily on her mind. In any case, even if she wanted to, her hands are stuck behind her back by the handcuffs, and her feet, though they're bare, aren't nearly flexible enough to turn the pages. She scans their titles instead. The Very Hungry Caterpillar, Fox in Socks, Peepo, The Cops and the Robbers, What Do You Do with a Kangaroo, Where the Wild Things Are, The Man Whose Mother Was a Pirate, Pass the Jam, Jim. The titles are like stories in themselves. Some of the books have fallen apart, or else been torn, their pages scattered across the floor. It would make her sad if her heart wasn't full already with a dizzying cargo of emotions. She's not a little girl. She's a hungry. It's too crazy, too terrible to be true, but too obvious now to be ignored. The hungry that turned from her at the base, when it could have eaten her. That could have been anything. Or nothing. It could have smelled Dr. Selkirk's blood and been distracted by that. Or it could have been looking for someone bigger to eat. Or the blue disinfectant gel could have disguised Melanie's smell the way the shower chemicals always disguised the smell of the grown-ups. But outside, just now, when she stepped in front of Sergeant Parks, impulsive, without thinking, wanting to fight the monsters the same way he did, instead of hiding from them like a big scaredy cat. They didn't even seem to see her. They certainly didn't hunger for her, the way they did for everyone else. It was like she was invisible, like there was a bubble of pure nothing where Melanie was. That's not the big proof, though. That's the little proof that pushes her up against the big proof, which is so very big that she wonders how she could have failed to see it right away. It's the word itself. The name. Hungries. The monsters are named for the feeling that filled her when she smelled Miss Justineau in the cell, or the junker men outside the block. The hungries smell you, and then they chase you until they eat you. They can't stop themselves. Melanie knows exactly how that feels, which means she's a monster. It makes sense now why Dr. Caldwell thinks it was okay to cut her up on a table and put pieces of her in jars. The door behind her opens, making almost no sound. She turns to see Dr. Caldwell standing in the doorway, staring down at her. The expression on Dr. Caldwell's face is complicated and confusing. Melanie flinches back from it. "Whatever the pertinent factor is," Dr. Caldwell says, her voice a quick, low murmur, "you're its apogee. Do you know that? Genius-level mind and all that grey muck growing through your brain doesn't affect it one bit. Ophiocordyceps should have eaten out your cortex until all that's left is motor nerves and random backfires. But here you are." She takes a step forward, and Melanie locksteps back away from her. "I'm not going to harm you," Dr. Caldwell says. "There's nothing I can do out here anyway. No lab, no scopes. I just want to look at gross structures. The root of your tongue, your tear ducts, your esophagus. See how far the infection has progressed. It's something, something to be going on with. The rest will wait. But you're a crucially important specimen, and I can't just..." When Dr. Caldwell reaches for her, Melanie ducks under her grip and sprints for the door. Dr. Caldwell spins and lunges almost fast enough. The tips of her fingers slide across Melanie's shoulder, but the bandages make her clumsy and she doesn't manage to catch a hold. Melanie runs as if there was a tiger behind her. Hearing Dr. Caldwell's furious gasp, "Damn! Melanie!" Out into the big room with the chairs around the edges, Melanie doesn't even know if she's being followed because she doesn't dare look back. Bile rises in her throat as she thinks of the lab and the table and the long-handled knife. In her panic, she just runs through the first door she sees, not even sure if it's the right one. It's not. It's the kitchen and she's trapped. She makes a sound inside the muzzle, an animal squeal. She runs back out into the chair room. Dr. Caldwell is on the other side of it. The door to the corridor is halfway between them. "Don't be stupid," Dr. Caldwell says. "I won't hurt you. I just want to examine you." Melanie starts to walk towards her, head down, docile. "That's right," Dr. Caldwell soothes. "Come on." When Melanie comes level with the door that leads out to the corridor, she bolts through it. Since she doesn't know where she's going, it doesn't matter what turns she takes, but she remembers them anyway. Left, left, right. She can't help herself. It's the same instinct that made her memorize the return route to the cell block when Sergeant Parks took her to Dr. Caldwell's lab. Home keeps meaning different things, but she has to know her way back to it. It's a need buried too deep in her to be pulled out. The corridors all look alike, and they offer no hiding places, at least not to someone who doesn't have the use of their hands. She runs past door after door, all closed. She goes to ground at last in an alcove, a slight widening of the corridor that creates an angle, a bulwark just wide enough for her body. It would only fool someone who wasn't actually looking for her, since anyone walking by would be able to see her just by turning their head. If Dr. Caldwell finds her, she'll run again. And if Dr. Caldwell catches her, she'll shout for Miss Justineau. That's her plan. The best she can come up with. Her ears are straining for the sounds of distant footsteps. When she hears the singing, from much closer, she jumps like a rabbit. "Now fetch me, my children." The voice is so hoarse it's almost not a voice at all. Breath forced through a crack in a wall, driven by a broken bellows. It's like a song that was left behind here by someone who died, and now it's gone back to the wild. And it's just those five words. Silence before and silence after. For about a minute, Melanie counts under her breath, trembling. "And fetch them. At speed." She doesn't jump this time, but she bites her lip. She can't imagine the mouth that would make that sound. She's heard of ghosts. Miss Justineau told the class some ghost stories once, but she stopped when she got too close to that whole taboo subject of death. And she wonders whether it might be a ghost of someone who died here, singing a song from when he was alive. Bid them hasten, or I shall be dead. She has to know. Even if it is a ghost, that won't be as scary as not knowing. She follows the sound out of the alcove and around a bend in the corridor. Light as red as blood comes through an open door, and it makes her scared for a moment. But as soon as she steps inside, she can see it's just the light of the sunset coming in through an open window. Just. She's only ever seen it once before, and this one's better. The sky catches fire from the ground on up, and the flames go through every colour, cooling from red-orange to violet and blue at the zenith. It blinds her, for at least 10 or 20 seconds, to the fact that she's not alone. Chapter 35. Caroline Caldwell also follows the sound of the strange voice. She's aware, of course, that it's not test subject number one who's singing, but equally she's sure that whoever it is doesn't represent a threat, until she sees him. The man sitting on the bed looks like the punchline to a bad joke. He's dressed in a hospital gown that's fallen open, exposing the nakedness beneath. Old wounds crisscross his body, deep troughs in the flesh of his shoulders, his arms, his face mark where he's been bitten. Except that bitten doesn't seem to cover it. He's been fed on. Lumps of his physical substance torn away and consumed. Scratches and tears ruck his chest and stomach, where the hungries who partially devoured him grabbed him and held on. The two middle fingers of his right hand have been bitten off at the second joint. A defence wound, Caldwell assumes, sustained when he tried to push a hungry away from him, and it bit down on his hand. The blackly comic touch is the bandage on his elbow. This man came to Wainwright House with something trivial like bursitis and, as many people do, experienced complications while he was being treated. In this case, the complications were that the hungries feasted on his flesh and made him one of them. He's still singing, seemingly unaware of Melanie standing directly in front of him, of Caldwell in the doorway of the room. The raven croaked as she sat at her meal. It's so apposite to her thoughts, Caldwell is thrown for a moment. But he's not answering her. He's only singing the last line of the quatrain. She knows the song, vaguely. It's The Woman Who Rode Double, an old folk ballad as depressing and interminable as most of its type, exactly the sort of song she'd expect a hungry to sing. Except that they don't. Ever. Another thing they don't do is look at pictures, but this one is. As he sings, he holds in his lap a wallet, of the kind that has a loose-leaf insert for credit cards. This one holds not cards, but photographs. The hungry is trying to flick through them, with one of the remaining fingers of his right hand. His movements are intermittent, and the gaps, in which he sits still, are very long. Each failure to turn to the next image elicits another line of the song. And the old woman knew what he said. Involuntarily, Caldwell's eyes find Melanie's. The glance they exchange asserts no kinship, unless it's a mark of consanguinity to be a rational and defined thing in the face of the impossible and the uncanny. Caldwell steps into the room and circles the infected man slowly and warily. The marks of violence he bears are, she sees now, very old. The blood from the wounds has mostly dried and flaked away. Each is rimmed with an embroidery of fine grey threads, the visible sign that Ophiocordyceps has made its home within him. There's a grey fuzz on his lips too, and in the corners of his eyes. It's possible, she thinks clinically, that he's remained in this room, on this bed, ever since he was infected. In that case, some of the bites on his arms might well have been self-inflicted. The fungus needs protein, primarily, and although it can make do with very little, it can't live on air. Auto-cannibalism is an eminently practical strategy for a parasite to which the host's body is only a temporary vector. Caldwell is utterly fascinated, but she's also, after what happened outside, aware of the need for caution. She retreats back to the door and beckons for the girl, the test subject, to join her there. Melanie stays exactly where she is. She's identified Caldwell as the greater threat, which is actually far from an unreasonable assumption. But Caldwell doesn't have time for this bullshit. She takes out the gun that Sergeant Parks gave her, which up until now has rested undisturbed in the pocket of her lab coat. She thumbs the safety and holds it, in both hands, out towards Melanie, aiming at her head. Melanie stiffens. She's seen what guns can do at very close quarters. She stares at the barrel, sickly hypnotized by its nearness, its deadly potentiality. Caldwell beckons again, this time with a toss of her head. And she grew pale at the raven's tail. Melanie takes a long time to decide, but at last she crosses to Caldwell. Caldwell takes one hand off the gun, steers Melanie out through the door with a hand on her shoulder. She turns back to the male hungry. All kinds of sin I have rioted in, she sings. And now the judgment must be. The hungry shudders, a quick convulsion running through it. Caldwell steps hurriedly back, swivelling the gun to point it at the centre of the thing's chest. At this range, she can't miss. But the hungry doesn't charge. It just moves its head from side to side as though it's trying to locate the source of the sound. So, it rasps in that almost not there voice. So, so, so. Leave him alone, Melanie whispers fiercely. He's not hurting you. But I secured my children's souls, Caldwell croons. So pray, my children, for me. So, the hungry croaks. So. Get out of the way, Sergeant Park says. His hand is on Caldwell's shoulder, brusquely pushing her aside. Fee, the hungry says. Parks fires once. A neat black circle, like a caste mark, appears in the centre of the hungry's forehead. It slips down sideways, rolling off the bed. Ancient stains, black and red and grey, mark the place where it has sat for so long. Why? Caldwell wails in spite of herself. She turns to the sergeant, her arms thrown wide. Why do you always... always shoot them in the fucking head! Park stares back at her stony-faced. After a moment, he takes her right hand in his left and pushes it down until it's pointing at the ground. You want to get demonstrative with a gun in your hand, he says. You make sure the safety is on. Chapter 36. Considering how badly it started, their second night on the road is a lot better than their first, at least in Helen Justineau's opinion. For starters, they've got food to eat. Even more miraculously, they've got something to cook it with, because the range in the tiny kitchen is powered by gas cylinders. The one that's already hooked up is empty, but there are two full ones standing in the corner of the room, and they're both still sound. The three of them, Justineau, Parks and Gallagher, go through the treasure trove of canned goods in the kitchen cupboards by the light of electric torches and of a nearly full moon shining in from outside, exclaiming in wonder or disgust at what's on offer. Justineau makes the mistake of checking the best before dates, which, of course, are all at least a decade in the past, but Parks insists that they're okay. Or at least some of them will be, by the law of averages. And a can whose contents have oxidized will smell really bad when it's opened, so they can just keep on rolling the dice until their luck is in. Justin, who weighs up the risk against the absolute certainty of protein and carbohydrate mix number 3. She picks up a can opener that she's found in a drawer and starts to open the cans. There are some horrific encounters, but Parks's theory holds. Maybe 30 or 40 cans later, they end up with a menu of beef in gravy with baby new potatoes, baked beans and mushy peas. Parks lights the range with a spark struck from a tinderbox, an honest-to-God tinderbox that has to be centuries old, produced from his pocket with something suspiciously like a flourish, and Gallagher cooks while Justin, who wipes dust off the plates and cutlery and washes them clean with a dribble of water from one of the canteens. Melanie and Dr. Caldwell play no part in any of this. Caldwell sits on one of the chairs in the day room, laboriously removing and adjusting and rewinding the dressings on her hands. She wears an expression of furious intensity and doesn't answer when spoken to. You could almost believe she's sulking. But in Justinu's opinion, what they're seeing is raw thought. The doctor is in. Melanie is in the next room along, which evidently used to be some kind of play space for kids to hang out in while their parents were here as visitors or inmates. She's been quiet and subdued ever since they arrived. It's hard to get a word out of her. Parks refused absolutely to free her hands, but at least there are posters on the walls for her to look at, and the remains of a bright red beanbag for her to sit on. Her ankle is tethered to a radiator by a short restraint chain, giving her freedom of movement within a circle about 7 feet in diameter. When the food is ready, Justinu takes some through to her. She's sitting on the beanbag, her legs crossed, her bright blue eyes staring with fixed intensity at a poster on the wall depicting voles, shrews, badgers, and other British wildlife. There's a light yellow fuzz on the top of her head, Justinu notices, the first hint of hair starting to grow back. It puts her in mind of a newly hatched chick. She sits with Melanie while she eats. According to Caldwell, hungries can only metabolize protein, so Justinu has washed some cubes of beef clean of the gravy they came in and put them in a bowl. Melanie is a little freaked out that the meat is hot. Justinu has to blow on each cube before she feeds it to the girl through the steel grill of her muzzle on the end of a fork. Melanie doesn't seem impressed, but she thanks Justinu very politely. Long day, Justinu observes. Melanie nods but says nothing. Now the meal is out of the way, Justinu shows Melanie what else she's found. In a few of the rooms there were clothes in the wardrobe or the drawers. One of them must have been occupied by a girl once, probably a bit younger than Melanie, but of a roughly similar size. Melanie stares at the clothes that Justinu holds out without comment. Somber and withdrawn as she is, it's obvious that they still fascinate her. Pink jeans, with a unicorn embroidered on the back pocket. A pastel blue t-shirt emblazoned with the motto, "Born to Dance." An aviator jacket, also pink, with button-up flaps at the shoulders and lots of pockets. White knickers and rainbow-striped socks. Trainers with jewel-spangled laces. "Do you like them?" Justinu asks. Melanie hasn't spoken, but her gaze flicks backwards and forwards between the strange offerings, studying them or perhaps comparing them. "Yes," she says. "I think so. But..." She hesitates. "What?" "I don't know how to put them on." "Of course." Melanie's strange offerings, studying them or perhaps comparing them. "Yes," she says. "I think so. But..." She hesitates. "What?" "I don't know how to put them on." "Of course." Melanie has never worn clothes with buttons or zip fasteners. And then she's got the chain, and the handcuffs to contend with. I'll help you, Justinu promises. We can't do anything until morning, but before we get moving again, I'll ask Sergeant Parks to untie you for a few minutes. We'll get you out of that mouldy old sweater and into your glad rags. Thank you, Miss Justinu. The little girl's face is solemn. We'll need the other soldier to be here too. Justinu is a little thrown by this. They don't need to watch while you change, she says. I think we'll make them wait in the next room, don't you? Melanie shakes her head. No.
No.
One to untie me, the other to point the gun at me. That's how many it takes.
Chapter 37. They talk for a little while longer about the things that have happened, wrapping the violence up in careful, delicate words so it feels less horrible. Melanie finds this interesting in spite of herself, that you can use words to hide things, or not to touch them, or to pretend that there's something different than they are. She wishes she could do that with her big secret. It seems like Miss Justinu thinks that Melanie must be sad because all those Hungries got killed and is trying to make her feel better about it. Melanie is sad for them, a little, but she knows enough now to be sure that the Hungries weren't really people anymore, even before they got killed. They were more like empty houses where people used to live. Melanie tries to reassure Miss Justinu, tries to show her that she's not so very sad about the Hungries. Not even about the man who was singing the song, although it seemed to her that there was no reason at all for Sergeant Parks to shoot him. He was just sitting there on the bed, and it didn't look like he could even get up. All he could do was sing and look at his pictures. But the lady outside had looked harmless too, until Dr. Caldwell screamed. It seemed like Hungries could change very quickly, and you had to be careful all the time when you were close to them. I'll keep you safe, Miss Justinu says to Melanie now. You know that, right? I won't let any of them hurt you. Melanie nods. She knows that Miss Justinu loves her, and that Miss Justinu will try her best. But how can anyone save her from herself? Chapter 38. I found this, Gallagher says when Helen Justinu comes back to the table. Her own food has gone cold by this time, and the rest of them have almost finished eating, but he felt like this was something they all had to be there for. He thinks Helen Justinu has a sexy smile for an older woman, and he hopes one day she'll use it on him. He sets down on the table a bottle that he found in a storage cupboard while they were searching. It was on the floor, covered with a pile of mouldering J-cloths, and he wouldn't have even seen it at all except that he kicked it by accident and heard the clink and slosh as its contents were disturbed. Glancing down, he saw a little of the label, a teasing hint of brown and gold where the sheltering mound of sky-blue cloths had slid away. Metaxa 3-star brandy, full and unopened. On his own account, he recoiled from it and from the poisoned release it represented. He piled the cloths on top of it again to hide it from sight. But he kept going back to it. He'd been fretting all day about this journey, about going back to Beacon and the narrow, walled-in world he'd been so happy to leave behind. He'd been feeling like he was walking between the rock and the hard place. Maybe, he thought, desperate situations require desperate remedies. The others stare at the bottle now, their dangling conversation comprehensively hijacked. Shit, Sergeant Parks murmurs, with something of reverence in his tone. This is the good stuff, right? Gallagher asks, feeling himself blush.
No. Sergeant Parks shakes his head slowly. No, this isn't so great, all things considered. But it's real. Not tin bucket rot gut.
He turns the bottle over in his hands, examines the seal both by eye and by sniffing at it.
Promises well, he comments. Normally I wouldn't get out of bed for anything less than French cognac, but fuck it. Get some glasses, Private.
Gallagher does.
He doesn't get that smile from Justinu. She's almost as switched off as Dr. Caldwell, like all the piled-up crises of the day have strung out her nerves too far and thin for normal stuff. But what's even cooler than a smile would have been is that the Sarge pours for him first.
"Founder of the feast, Private," he says when he's filled all their glasses. "You get to give the toast."
Gallagher's already hot face gets a bit hotter. He raises the glass. "One bottle for the four of us. Thank fuck there are no more of us," he recites. One of his fathers, heard in a roar that carried through thin floorboards to where a pre-teen Kieran Gallagher lay under a single blanket and listened to the grown-ups carouse. Then call each other cunts. Then fight. The toast is accepted. The glasses chinked together. They drink. The raw, sweet booze sears its way down Gallagher's throat. He tries his best to keep his mouth closed on it, but he explodes into coughing. Not as bad as Dr. Caldwell, though. She claps her hand to her mouth and, as the cough rises despite her best efforts, sprays brandy and spit out between her fingers. They all laugh out loud, including the doctor. In fact, she laughs the longest. The laughing takes up each time the coughing stops and then gives way to it again. It's like alcohol is magic, and they've all suddenly relaxed with each other even though they've only taken a single mouthful of it. Gallagher remembers enough of those family drinking sessions to be sceptical of that particular miracle.
"Your turn,"
the Sarge says to Justinu, pouring again. "For a toast? Oh, shit." Justinu shakes her head, but she lifts the brimming glass. "May we live as long as we want. How about that?" She tips it back, drinks the glass empty in one go. The Sarge matches her. Gallagher and Dr. Caldwell sip more cautiously. "It's may we live as long as we want, and never want as long as we live," Gallagher corrects Justinu. He knows this stuff like holy writ. Justinu sets the glass back down. "Yeah, well," she says, "no point in asking for the moon and the stars, is there?" The Sarge refills their glasses, tops up Gallagher's and Caldwell's.
"Doc?"
he asks. Caldwell shrugs. She's not interested in offering any heartwarming exhortations. Parks taps each of their glasses with his own three times round.
"To the wind that blows, the ship that goes, and the lass that loves a sailor."
"You know any sailors?" Justinu asks sardonically, after they've both emptied their glasses again and Gallagher has sipped politely. They're already making serious inroads into the bottle.
"Every man's a sailor," Parks says. "Every woman's an ocean."
"Horse shit," Justinu exclaims. The Sarge shrugs.
"Maybe. But you'd be amazed how often it works."
More laughter, with a slightly wild edge to it. Gallagher stands. This is no good for him, and he was stupid to try it. He started to remember things that he steers clear of most of the time for good and sufficient reasons. Ghosts are rising in his sight, and he doesn't want to have to look them in the eye. He knows them too well already.
"Sarge," he says, "I'll swing round one more time. Make sure everything's secure." "Good for you, son," Park says.
They don't even look at him as he leaves. He wanders round the corridors of the first floor level, finding nothing that they didn't find the time before. He covers his mouth and nose as he walks past the room with a dead hungry in it. The stink is really bad. But it's worse when he gets to the top of the staircase that the Sarge blew out. It's like the breath of hell right there. There's no sound, no movement. Gallagher stands at the brink and peers down into impenetrable shadow. Eventually he gets up the courage to take the torch from his belt, aim it straight down, and click it on. In the perfect circle of the torchlight, he sees six or seven hungries crammed shoulder to shoulder. The light makes them squirm and surge, but they're too tightly packed to move very far. Gallagher plays the torch's beam forward and back. The whole length of the hall, They're packed in like sardines. The Hungries they were running from a few hours ago, and their friends, and their friends' friends. They move peristaltically as the light passes over them. Their jaws open and close. The sound of gunshots brought them, from wherever they happen to be. Something loud means something living. Now they're here, and they'll stay here until they score a meal, or until the next big thing winds up their fungus-fucked clockwork and sets them moving. Gallagher retreats, sickened and scared. He's lost his enthusiasm for being night watchman. He goes back to the day room. Parks and Justinu are still working their way through the bottle, while Dr. Caldwell is stretched out asleep across three chairs. He thinks maybe he should check in on the hungry kid. Should at least make sure the tether tying her to the radiator is still secure. He goes through to the room with the toys in it. The kid is sitting on the beanbag, really still and quiet, head down and staring at the floor. Gallagher stifles a shiver. She looks, for a moment, exactly like the monsters filling the downstairs hall. He props the door open with a chair. He's buggered if he's going to be alone with this thing in the near dark. He walks across to her, making a fair amount of noise so she knows he's coming. She looks up, and it's a relief to him when she does. It's not that rangefinder thing that the Hungries do when they look past you on both sides before zeroing in on you. It's more like what a human being would do. "What have you got there?" Gallagher asks her. The floor is littered with books, so presumably that's what she was looking at. With her hands cuffed behind her back, looking is all she can do. He picks up the nearest book, The Water Babies by Charles Kingsley. It looks really old, with a faded dust jacket on the cover torn at one corner. The picture shows a bunch of cute little fairies rising into the air over the rooftops of a city. London, maybe. But Gallagher has never seen London and doesn't have any way of knowing. The hungry kid is watching him and not saying a word. It's not an unfriendly look, but it's really intent. Like she doesn't know what he's there for, and she's ready for the surprise not to be a nice one. All she knows of him is that he's one of the people who used to tie her up in that chair all the time and wheel her in and out of the classroom. Gallagher can't remember now if he's ever spoken to her before this. Consequently, the words come out a little skewed, a little self-conscious. He's not even all that sure why he says it. "You want me to read this to you?" A moment's silence. A moment more of that big-eyed stare. "No," the kid says. "Oh." That's his entire conversational strategy shot to shit. He doesn't have a plan B. He heads for the door again and the lighted room beyond. He swung the chair out of the way and he's about to close the door behind him when she blurts it out. "Can you look on the shelves?" He turns and steps back inside, replacing the chair. "What?" There's a long silence, like she's sorry she spoke and she's not sure she wants to say it again. He waits her out. "Can you look on the shelves? Miss Justinu gave me a book, but I had to leave it behind. If the same book is here..."
"Yeah?"
"Then you could read me that." Gallagher hadn't noticed the bookcase before. He follows the girl's gaze now, sees it against the wall next to the door.
"Okay," he says. "What was the book called?"
"Tales the Muses Told." There's a quickening of excitement in the girl's voice. "By Roger Lancelin Green. It's Greek myths." Gallagher goes over to the bookcase, clicks on his torch and plays it over the shelves. Most of these are picture books for little kids, with stapled spines rather than square ones, so he has to pull them out to see what they're called. There are a few real books, though, and he works his way through them painstakingly. No Greek myths. "Sorry," he says. "It's not here. You don't want to try something new?"
"No."
"Is Postman Pat here? And his black and white cat?" He holds up a book to show her. The hungry kid gives it a cold stare, then looks away. Gallagher rejoins her, pulls up a chair at what he considers a safe distance.
"My name's Kieran," he tells her.
This elicits no response at all.
"Is there one story in particular that's your favourite?"
But she doesn't want to talk to him, and he can understand that. Why the hell would she?
"I'm going to read this one," he says.
He holds up a book called I Wish I Could Show You. It's got the same kind of pictures in it as The Cat in the Hat, which is why he chose it. He used to love that story about the cat and the fish and the kids and the two things called One and Two. He liked to imagine his own house getting trashed like that, and then getting put right again just a second before his dad walked in. For Gallagher, aged about 7, that was a huge, illicit thrill.
"I'm going to sit here and read this one," he tells the girl again. She shrugs like that's his business, not hers.
Gallagher opens the book. The pages are damp, so they stick to each other a little, but he's able to pull them apart without tearing them.
"When I was out walking one day in the street," he recites, "I met a young man with red boots on his feet. His belt had a buckle, his hat had a feather. His shirt was of silk, and his pants were of leather. And he could not stand still for 2 seconds together." The kid pretends not to listen, but Gallagher isn't taken in. It's pretty obvious that she's tilting her head so she can see the pictures.
Chapter 39. Parks shares out some more of the brandy. It's going fast. Justinu drinks, although she's just reached the stage where she knows it's a bad idea. She'll wake up feeling like shit. She fans her face, which is uncomfortably hot. Booze always does this to her, even in medicinal amounts.
"Jesus," she says, "I've got to get some air."
But there isn't much air to be had. The window is safety locked and opens all of 5 inches.
"We could go up to the roof," Park suggests. "There's a fire door at the end of the corridor that leads up there."
"Anything to say the roof is safe?" Justinu asks, and the sergeant nods. Yeah, of course he would have checked it. Love him or hate him, he's the kind of man who's built his identity around the blessed sacrament of getting the job done. She saw that out on the green, when he saved all their lives by reacting pretty nearly as fast as the Hungries did.
"Okay," she says, "let's see what the roof is like."
And the roof is just fine. About 10 degrees cooler than the day room, with a good, stiff wind blowing in their faces. Well, good is maybe overstating it, because the wind smells of rot, like there's a big mountain of spoiled meat right next to them, invisible in the dark, and they're inhaling its taint. Justinu clamps her glass over the lower half of her face like an oxygen mask, and breathes brandy breath instead.
"Any idea what that is?"
she asks Parks, her voice muffled and distorted by the glass.
"Nope, but it's stronger over here," Parks says, "so I suggest we go over there."
He leads the way to the southeast corner of the building. They're facing London and distant Beacon, the home that flung them out and is now reeling them back in. Justinu lets absence work its usual magic, even though she knows damn well that Beacon is a shithole. A big refugee camp governed by real terror and artificially pumped up optimism, like the bastard child of Butlins and Colditz. It was already well on the way to totalitarianism when she lucked her way out of there, and she's not looking forward to finding out what it's become in the 3 years that have passed since.
But where else is there?
"The doc's a real character, isn't she?" Parks muses, leaning over the parapet wall and staring out into the darkness. Moonlight paints the town in woodcut black and white like a picture from a book. Black predominates, turning the streets into unfathomable riverbeds of rushing air.
"That's one word for what she is," Justinu says.
Parks laughs, jokingly raises the glass, like they're toasting their shared opinion of Caroline Cordwell.
"Truth is," he says, "in a way, I'm glad the whole thing's over. The base, I mean, and the mission. Not glad we're on the run, obviously, and I'm praying we're not the only ones who got away. But I'm glad I don't have to do that anymore.
Do what?